So I want to jump right into it. Hyunjin, do you want to comment on any of what we have seen in the last an hour and a half or 2 hours?
Yes. Well, the Propeller Group's film, you just watch it, it's from the funeral ceremony traditions, which is still in South Vietnam, you can still find out a lot. And I mean, it seems like it's very eccentric, might be for you, but it's there's a tradition when there is a funerals, someone died in your community, the transgender people comes and they, I mean, it's not without any official invitation, they just came and they do the lots of several rituals for the someone who passed away. So what I found interesting in this film is actually somehow the south of Vietnam is the seen as a really border, this confusion, funeral culture meets up the Southeast Asian synthetic religious culture also. So you see some of the custom is actually, it's really the same of the Korean traditional funeral custom. So, you know, in early Asia, when there were kind of influenced a lot by Chinese emperor, somehow the China, they removed a lot of Confucianist ritual culture, but the margin of the China, the country, like Korea and Hong Kong still have, also Cantonese regions, and also Vietnam, you could find these Confucianist funeral cultures. But that in the south of Vietnam, it especially it meets of the more kind of crazy synthetic combination with other like a brass, you know, band. They're playing music, so it's kind of more Western influence might be. It's might be from somewhere else, and also there's queer gender, transgender, actually, they're dancing and they're doing many performance. And I think these are kind of coincide, or it could be interesting found in the one of documentary that I recently saw. It's documented from by the Kiki Fabrianti, and her film, there's a film Chararai, and it's about Bugis cultures in Indonesia. And the film talk about Sulawesi women. And Bugis, they have actually, in their certain text, they have the gender diversity concept already. So they says as a five different gender, and there's actually the bisexual person seen as a certain medium to connect with the God. So here's, we see the transgender people become a medium to connect the earth to the heaven. So they are to become a sort of the one who channeling between two different worlds. So, which I, it was kind of really intriguing for me to think about all these elements.
I think it also leads us into the question we wanted to speak about in the next 20 minutes or so. We've been borrowing the title of our conversation from a project Hyunjin Kim organized in the Aqua Art Center in 2014, together, among others, with David Tay. And I'd like you to begin by explaining what you mean with unrealized.
Well, for me, I mean, it's kind of a known fact tradition is sort of the story that is invented during the modern modern times. So like nation, it's also stories, and you know, capital is also stories in a way. But the tradition that is sort of more exaggerated by the people's nostalgia, who think that they lost the past, like a pre-modern times of the life custom, but also partly in Western society, but in Asian society, like especially in Korea, tradition was become a strong apparatus for the nationalism too. So then I need to revisit it. It's somehow it's critical way it needs to think about these how the tradition has been dealt. And there was a sort of the in my community, the artists and composer, musician, performers, they're pretty interested about the traditional culture, but also there were a lot of projects to reinvestigate about what is the traditional culture or the meaning of the tradition in terms of contemporary times, but also how this kind of uneasy relation to the tradition might be revisited, because we are grown up in the it's totally by the Western systemized education, and somehow there's not much contact with the traditional culture, and either we saw traditional culture as more like a national within the national system, for example, tangible asset or intangible asset. So tangible asset is like a bridge or the gate from the Joseon dynasty that is still remained as a precious treasures, and then the intangible asset is a human skill or resource that bring up this kind of early pre-modern tradition. But it means like asset, it means also become capitalized also within the system. So, but then as a story, why not we think about as a something different way? So it can be unpacked as a different stories, and also we somehow ended up, we kind of interestingly revealed that we ended up tradition, but somehow like today the siren was presented, Yeoseonggukguk, but during the time of 50-60, so it's like a Cold War period, but also like it's a time of the threshold, like become modern, right? So it's a time to become modern, but the time has an interesting aspect, like you could still find this kind of encounter with the pre-modern or the traditions meeting with the certain kind of a modern attitude, but also kind of modern environment. So interestingly find out this meeting point, but also it's sort of still border making process. So that was somehow like, yeah, it's really intriguing for me to initiate this project.
I want to stay with that trouble of the term tradition for a moment longer, just because obviously when using that term, we are on the one hand in this kind of double bind of, I think Juk Hoi yesterday referred very concisely to one of these problems that you also mentioned, this kind of foundational melancholia that is part of that loss of a cosmos, and then by seeking to regain it becomes reifies in inventing certain traits of culture, reifies them, and often also puts them on the plate for a reactionary and a right-wing politics, not merely a nationalistic one. No? Or if it's not a right-wing approach in the sense of, you know, an essentialist approach to some sort of idea of purity and origin stories, it might also, as we see, for instance, in Jane Jin Kaisen's film, be commodified to become a commodity in the service of nation branding. And we'll get to discuss that in a bit. No, just maybe that you could be a bit explicit about what else do we need to or can we do, and did you attempt to do in that project, Tradition Unrealized, together with the artists and writers involved, with that object, with and its ambivalences, the object that is so many things, tradition.
Yeah. For me, when I started the project, it was more genuine curiosity. I didn't want to unpack from the beginning with the prejudice about the tradition, because it already, like, you know, my father and mother generation, who also, you know, studied in 60, 50, I think that time, like a 70, they were gone through this government's highly emphasized of the westernizations, and that means like rationalizations in the culture. So they have certain kind of tendency to see as a certain tradition as a little bit like uncivilized, or, you know, like especially for the elite class, they are more really into more rationalized thinking in a Western way. But then I have a kind of a very good memory with my grandparents. So I was more have a pure curiosity in my memories, and also actually it's strangely, like as I said, in my generation has some shared interests, by coincidence or sort of there might be some kind of cultural interests invoked together, might be influence each other. But this, especially, I have some close friend who actually trained as a Korean dancer from 6 year old, from the really little kid. So it's like they're trained as an apprentice system from the really kids. But then they have agonized by these kind of certain very authorized master systems, and they went to contemporary choreography field, but then they re-realized what they neglected already they had in the traditional dance. So sort of the understanding the form as a more different way. So there's several researches, like Siren was also part of it, and Changgyeong was talking about tradition, how in terms of the also the Orientalism, which is also we have this kind of critical point through these critics of the Orientalism by the you know, Edo side, and so it was also internalized within the East Asian culture to not to operate certain cultural code as an orientalistic intention. So, but then it's like a sort of like a lot of self-censorship, like whether you are really operating orientalistic value toward the Western, you know, society, or you somehow you grown up certain part of the traditional culture, but you have to negate. And there's certain way that all these kind of ambivalent engagement around the traditional culture. So there's a certain doubt, but there's also kind of the necessary to recognize it as a to speak for yourself a certain different stories from your own regions, and you know. So I think these are dealt through the some of the project. Also, there is a one speaker by Professor Yoon Young-do was mentioning, in a way, the Cold War period in East Asia, especially Taiwan and South Korea. The tradition was become an apparatus to recall the memory in up to kind of as an antithesis to what North Korea or mainland China, they brought up the tradition. So when they emphasize tradition, then there's a anti-mirroring. So when the Taiwanese government emphasized tradition and South Korea emphasized tradition, then the mainland China Communist Party, they removed the tradition as a certain kind of absurd culture that from the bourgeoisies and elite class from the pre-modern. So there's a kind of reverse recall of the traditions going on during the Cold War period too.
It's not, in fact, only the Cold War, no? That is, I mean, in China, it starts with the May 4th movement, really, this, like, to modernize the country means to be iconoclastic of tradition. Obviously, not limit, I mean, this is a central part of, let's say, perhaps the drama of the left in the 20th century. On the other hand, it is certainly not only a question of the left. So maybe we could, I want to go into this concrete case of Korean shamanism, which when Hyunjin and myself were producing the animism exhibition in 2013 for the museum that you were directing back then, Ilmen Museum, this was a minor threat, a minor story in the exhibition that has since stayed with me very strongly, and it came to us, among other things, through the work of Park Chung-kyung, who's been working on this question of the shamanistic tradition and its resignifications across history for a long time, and we will perhaps hear him later on about this as well. So this image that is part of Park Chung-kyung's work is such an example of an iconoclasm, no? Of a destruction of tradition in order to move forward, in order to subscribe to a modernization process, in order to move from one economic model and its symbolic system to another. Clearly sort of situates the shamanistic slash animistic traditions as the other of modernization, while today, only a couple of decades later, that contradiction and that antagonism seem no longer to exist. And that is, for me, a big question, the why, right? Like, how come the status of certain cultural practices and traditions has so radically changed? And I guess there are several answers to that question that I'd like to explore a bit. So maybe you could start by speaking a bit about this image.
Yeah, this is the image from Shindoan, actually, the one of anonymous photographer who are a kind of village officer who has been long-term documented this Shindoan village, where the lot of religious group, actually the communities and the shamanists there gathered and they lived. since Japanese colonial period until was actually going on until 80s and 90s. There the National Air Force headquarters was settled, so they are almost gone now. But the one mountain is known as a more full of spirituality. That's the Kaeryong Mountain. So its village is really in the Kaeryong Mountain. And during the 60s, actually, the Dictator Park start to do the national campaign. So every January, like New Year's Day, there is a the newspaper was celebrating New Year's Day, but at the same time, in the first page, there is a constant campaign about remove superstitions. So you have to remove the superstitions, and this is like a disease, and if you are ill, you shouldn't go to Xiamen, you have to go to the hospital. And this kind of campaign was really announced every day from late 60s to until the 70s. So actually, this material we could found out a lot during we worked together for the animism show. So, and it's kind of...
So that image we see is actually a propaganda image,
yeah.
Right?
So these images are the one of the scene. There's a war. There's signboard. It says destroying superstitions, and the man, old man, is burning out this tiger images. There's a tiger together with the god. And they're burning out. So it means that literally it has to destroy this as a superstitious culture. So, but these are actually the yesterday Miyu was talking about Manchuria, but this dictator was highly influenced by this Manchuria's high modern development. So the Manchu, as in the Manchukuo puppet states by the Japanese government, that's all about bringing modern technology, infrastructures, and rationalizations. But then, so he adopts these Manchu as a model to develop the country, and it means also westernizations and rationalizations. But then somehow it's also like it's not only Manchu. I think they also got a support. I mean, this dictator got a support by the United States, and also he came actually the one time in Germany to see the Autobahn. So he was amazed by this Autobahn as a big glory of the Western modernity, and he literally brought this model to South Korea to develop the highways and. So yeah, that's so that this tradition is actually start to really removed around the time.
I just wonder. I mean, obviously, this kind of image has a long genealogy. As it's curious, also just to relate back to that Cold War geography, that it's roughly contemporaneous with the Cultural Revolution destruction of. traditions and everything belonging to the old China, which is here downstairs in the exhibition alluded to by Xu Jiawei's work and the god that was forced to migrate, but of course has a much longer history to it as well that reaches back to all the way to the origins of enlightenment thought and the colonial project in relation to the destruction of fetishes, for instance. But then today, when you look at that sort of long history of an image like that and its manifestation in this under the condition of military dictatorship and this brutal modernization campaign, and you look at what shamanism has become since this 3, 4, 5 decades, something has changed, right? Can you try to explain or elaborate on that?
Well, ironically, there is a government, though the long government campaign, but I mean, the Chang Kyung's fantastic film, Thousand God, the Mansion, was actually showing this whole history. This film we don't have here, but we don't show in an exhibition, but he's one of the well-known film documentary in last couple of years. It was talking about how the there's a one woman figure is known as a really great shaman. She was oppressed highly during the 60s, 70s, but in 80 by the Chonduan, he's another military dictator. He used this traditional code, including this shamanism, as a sort of soothing to people who has been gone through long-term dictatorship. So it's become like, you know, national apparatus, but also in a way still contemporary time. We also see a lot of news, you know, because we also revealed the newspaper in the 90s talking about every election time the politician go to shamans and fortune teller to ask about their future. So it's like these kind of elite, the politicians, or you know, it's even they pretend to be rational, but this shamanistic culture is really close to the everyday life, actually. So there is a kind of dubious attitude about the shamanisms, and the Chang Kyung has once emphasized that it's this sort of the snobism, but whether even though they actually behind scene they were they're living with the shamanism, but they're kind of pretend to ignore the shamanism as a part of life. And this sort of dubious attitude, it in a way, it's sort of embodiment of this kind of the westernization, but it is also the one of the thing that has to be contested in the contemporary societies.
I mean, it's a highly complex question, no? Maybe one more round, just to, because what I find quite striking, on a very basic level, is that even though, of course, whatever it is used and used for, its basic status has, in relation to a modernizing nation, has somehow transformed in the sense that it is no longer, you don't need an image like that anymore. Mm-hmm. Rather, it is becoming either that sort of dubious part of everyday life, or it is becoming branded national heritage culture, meaning almost marketing. No? So it has both this status as subterranean, sometimes subaltern knowledge, and that sort of almost touristic commodity culture. And this still, I'm still not getting quite my head around as to what exactly has enabled that change. Why is it no longer dangerous so as to require an image like that? Is that because these campaigns were simply so successful that whatever remains of it is no longer dangerous? But that's also not quite the case, right?
Yeah, it's difficult question, but it's I want to cite what Chang Kyung was actually talking about. in the symposium we had in Korea. I mean, the sort of like embodiment of the Western criticism of Orientalism, you as a cultural figure also, you are, as I said, you are self-censoring constantly. And also by the national modernization process, it was oppressed. But then there are certain traditions. It was underestimated a lot. But also by the systemization of this intangible asset, the tradition was very fossilized by within the system. But then Changgyeong also said these in a way become the way to protect at least certain traditions that we can revisit. I mean, that we need certain kind of archive we could revisit, actually. But if you totally ignore it, then there is no way to revisit or no way to recall. I mean, it's the question is like how you recall about the tradition, I guess. It's sort of become another story that empowers your memories or like your different engagement to come to as a contemporary language. But then if there is nothing left and, you know, there's no way to come across, actually. So there is there's ambivalence, reconsideration actually had to engage, and which is not easy for us either because we also still, there's a certain generation, they highly want to distance about the tradition because they has big self-censorship and negation whether they're operating Orientalism as a sort of the capital toward the Westerns, you know, I think the Japan and Korea, there are certain generation, they are really highly afraid of this kind of trajectory. But our generation somehow, we are a little bit of the free from these baggages, and then we are curious about what we could revisit, like as a certain kind of archive, we could talk through the contemporary, you know, thinking and language. And I think these are kind of important for us. It's not just overwhelmed by this kind of Orientalistic criticism, but also how we engage in a more like autonomic way to the traditions. But I mean, obviously, there's a nationalistic kind of right-wing policies emphasize of tradition, like, you know, like as a huge agenda. But there's a huge criticism because these within that agenda, you know, the way they promote is that doesn't really come across. It often become more kind of the package of that we don't really inspire in terms of contemporary cultures or so. So that actually at the same time, there's a high criticism going on about what is neglected and what was wrongly treated by the government agenda about the traditions.
And it's obviously a huge narrative battlefield also, no? Of what memories it enables and on what level of representational politics and in this tension of reifying and opening up transformational potential. I mean, in the article that you wrote for our online publication in relationship to this project, you were also delving in the kind of cultural significance of these like sort of super representational events as part of a kind of transitional moment in that modernization story of the past few decades, in the sense of, not least in the sense of the transition from military dictatorship to democracy. So and also the relationship between Japan and Korea. So maybe we can dwell on that a little bit, the Olympic Games.
Yeah, I mean, it's the current known fact that it's Olympic. It's become really the way to develop the country economic way. So the Tokyo was held the Olympic in 1964, was quite successful. And then about 20 years later, there's 1988, there's Olympic Games in Seoul. And the Beijing was held in 2008. So it's almost like a 20 years gap between. And in Seoul Olympic especially, there was held around almost end of Cold War. So the Soviet Unions and East-Western countries and some of other communist countries, they all joined. And it was become really made a successful region for the as an event, but also it kind of the economically it helped a lot to develop the country actually, and then introduce the country to the global world. So and the following the Tokyo, it's the Tokyo Olympics, and it's I think that in East Asia countries especially, Olympics are always become the method to develop the country. So we have like 2020, there's another Tokyo Olympic coming, and the next year there's a Pyeongchang Winter Olympics actually going to held again. So it's a constant roof actually still, because it's East Asia, they are I was keep talking about this andromodernity, which is like a sole category adopting of the Western modernization process as a really the model. So this the like as a super modernity that has a development of the all infrastructures and the systemizations, and so these are the model really these East Asia country they followed, and but it doesn't mean it's not always the same. The democratization, it's kind of followed together, but it's somehow we got democratization in the 90s. So it's all about highly advanced and highly developed. And that's coming also followed by the global economic systems and neoliberal systems, etc.
Do you have more images?
This was...
Okay. So this would bring us back one more time to... or align us one more time with the work of Park Chung-hyung, but also something you have been looking into for a while, also in relationship to Manchuria and Manchukuo. I think the image of the waterfall is from the piece Kyoto School that Park Chung-hyung produced for this exhibition. And maybe as a final question before we can open up, I'd like you to, the whole complex of the Kyoto School and its relation to articulations of pan-Asianism, of course, is sort of shuffling that question of tradition and its instrumentalization or mobilization yet another time. So maybe you can talk about that.
Yes. Well, the concept and notion of Asia was actually was something new. It's also the story brought up during the modern time for Asian people. Actually, the notion of Asia was, it become clear figure of, or concept when there's Western colonizer, they start to invade. And Japan was highly interesting to talk about because Meiji Isshin, during the Meiji Isshin, Japan was obsessed to learn about Western to come close to the same level of the development of the Western society. So and then they are talking about Asianisms and Pan-Asianism a lot. Fukuzawa Yukiji, he was emphasizing escaping from the Asia, and then he dealt as Asia as a, like the rest of Asia, majority of the Asia as a more inferior. So the Western is a obviously superior. So the Japan has to come with to the same level as the Western out of this inferior their neighbor country. So, but then. Okukara Tenshin, he studied in Boston and art history. He's more talking about different quality of the Asia we found, and it's a love.
Can you introduce him quickly?
The Okukara Tenshin, he's also the scholar who studied in Boston in the United States in art history, but he was. He's also studied lots of the Asian, other Asian regions, the old Asian histories and art history. So from the India and to China. And so he has a more interest how he can bring about this different Asian culture from the Western culture and West or Western history, and then he saw he was emphasizing that it's Japan has all these collections of the Asian obsolete objects, antiquities, and that makes Japan as a museum of the Asia actually, and he's pretty interesting about this religious history of the Asia also. So he brought up that Himalaya image also emphasizing in his text in One Asia, the Himalaya has a two line. One goes to the until the south to the India, and one goes to this China plateau. So these two lines are sort of the Himalaya that's symbolized as a kind of the sole image of the Asia, so the One Asia. So
it's also interesting in respect to the kind of looming geopolitical fight over the resource that is connected to that water, no? Like the as some of you may know, Beijing is redirecting vast amounts of water from the Himalayas now, affecting, among others, the Bangladeshi economy and ecology on a vast scale, etc. So just as a side note.
So the interesting thing is like it's, this nature image, like a sublime nature image, become the method to like or medium to explain about these Asian spirits or Asianisms and sort of core of the what is Asian Asian is. So and then by the Changgyong's work at Kyoto School, I also encountered this Kekkonfo image become the method to talk about Japanese spirit. That is against, that is differentiated from the what is Western spirits or Western is, Westernism. So it's interesting to see the nature images or certain kind of the metaphysics coming from these nature images amongst Japanese scholars from the Okakura Tenshin and Kyoto School. They were also, both are highly influenced by the Western studies and Western cultures and literature philosophies, but they toward the kind of more abstract images, actually the abstract, sublimed abstract image of the nature become the way to talk about the concreteness of the Japanese-ness, or what is, through this Japanese-ness, it's become the way to differentiate what is Asian values and Asianism. So, I mean, this, and in this way, actually, there's also problems because it's in a way that Japan as a young empire around the began the Pacific Wall, and they had to claim what they are actually to the China actually they don't have much of the theory of the Pan-Asianism because China has been mostly very privileged old empire who think that they're the center of this world, or the at least like Asia, they were always the empire. But then it's Japan, somehow, they had a kind of double-sided desire. They want to be leader of the Asia, but then also they were agonized by, they had to learn, highly learn about the Western to be lead of the Asia, but also who had to confront as to, or as a protector of the Asia. So they're kind of a more complex desire or the projections or their ideas about Pan-Asianism. It's later it gone through the militarization of and to the war state. So there's a Kyoto School scholar Koyama, there's a Kyoto School scholar this who organized a symposium and then moderator was actually there's a moment he talked about certain kind of crystallized emotions. And when he read about the news, they attacked the Pacific, the Hawaii harbor, the Pearl Harbor, it become a moment for them to really emotionally find some sort of the solid identity, actually. So Japan become real empire to the same level of the Western. So these are, I mean, these sort of the emphasis of the Pan-Asianism has become very absurd in these kind of war states. And so, but they also, within them it's quite complex because they've been, they have certain kind of the agony they have to learn, but to come, become this, you know, like the same citizen, like Western. So, and also to somehow, they have kind of idea to, they are the protector for the Asia, but they, the other neighbor Asian country, they didn't agree about this idea. So it's like this complex agenda was made, this Japanese brutal, violent imperialism is constantly criticized until today, but it's interesting. Like in the Kyoto School, also there's a kind of cosmopolitan agendas, and throughout their learning of the Western literatures and philosophy, it's somehow it's interesting to see. It's not the simple agenda. It's like so. It's a kind of a antinomy. Like there's a lot of antinomy. What they did, their theory was adopted by the militarism of the Japan for the war. But it was the discourse was used for the Japanese militarism for the war. But it wasn't somehow we're not clear. It's intended or not intended. Actually, there is some, yeah, so it's
I mean, in an extremely condensed, crystallized form, the work downstairs sort of expresses or exposes this ambivalence. No? This I just also on a related note, James T. Hong, who has the work about the disputed islands in the Southeast China Sea downstairs, has, for an earlier project we did here, in the same year we had done animism in Korea and Seoul, called After Year Zero, where among other things we were looking into the relation of these various pan projects, like pan-Africanism, and James has written about pan-Asianism and the relationship between pan-Asianism and one of the founding figures of pan-Africanism, W.E.B. Du Bois, who upon visiting Japan, which in the early 20th century, because of its victory over Russia, and hence having been the first non-Western power to defeat a Western power, an imperial power, had this kind of iconic status in the non-Western or colonial world, but James discerns in this article one of these many, to add just one more ambiguity to that history, you know, like the implicit racism on the side of the Japanese proponents of a pan-Asianism, and curiously Du Bois's blindness to that very racism. It's a really interesting further aspect to that story.
Well, there was, yeah, I mean, I somehow think that Japan was somehow all like, kind of might be a model of the total neoliberal from the beginning of their Japanese Empire, because they once had a plan to have the Jewish community to live in the Manchuria area. It was actually planned by the Japanese government because they thought that the Jewish is known for the people who has a good with the economy. So they actually had this plan like to invite the Jewish people. So the mostly Russian Jewish, they were gathered in Manchuria. But then they got abandoned by Japanese government because of the alliance with the Germany in the Nazi Germans at the time.
They had already been in Harbin, no?
But there was actually the name of the plan. It's a Bogo Kehwek. So somehow, like it's all about how capitalize. You know how I mean that means the capitalize for the Japan is westernized also. So it's like the capitalistic agenda. It's so much in the behind the histories and it's. This is the race issue is also somehow it was just taken by this kind of economic agenda or abandoned by the certain kind of, you know, political changes and then how you align with whom. So actually the Japan, they just let the Jewish people live in Manchuria area, but they didn't, I mean, the Nazi, they pushed the Japanese government to do this Holocaust camp to the Japan, but they didn't accept it in a way. But they didn't. They kind of sort of abandoned, just as you know. So, but these are. I mean, I think that somehow there's a lot of confusion. I mean, these images invoke, again, the certain kind of confusion and a very abstract, and which is total unclearness about, you know, in ethical way, in a philosophical way, is total blurred situations between how they cope with these Western philosophies and it kind of combined together with fused with the Asian philosophy or the Asianisms and Japanese spirits. And I think somehow Changgyeong fantastically brought up this Kaegon Falls wall sword and this spray that's sort of seen as like a fall of empire, kind of, you know, scattered image of the empire. So for me, it becomes interest of this how this such kind of confusions or like all mixture of these all kinds of theories or discourse are just fallen like a waterfalls, you know. So they were emphasizing high spirits and sublime sublime spirits through the Kaegon Fall, but or the Himalaya, but it stayed as abstract actually. So abstract and then also quite dubious, yeah. It's an empty signifier and in a way like how you approach to it. So.
Okay, I'm going to close this session here. I think we've been referring a lot, also as you had collaborated several times before, to the work of Park Chung-kyung, and we will have the chance to listen to himself in the next session. I guess our task was to try to raise questions that were occupying first us in our collaboration, but also your work, informing your work of the past few years. And for several of the points that we've brought up, you find actually elaborations in Hyunjin's article that is online on the HKW Tiger site in our journal. So thanks a lot, and we'll have a break now and commence in 30 minutes. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.